Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Volney Gay, Professor of Psychiatry, Director of Psychotherapy Training, Professor of Religious Studies, Professor of Anthropology and Training and Supervising Analyst, the St. Louis Psychoanalytic Institute, about his recent book, On the Pleasures of Owning Persons, The Hidden Face of American Slavery. Volney, thanks for being willing to be with you.
Well, thank you for being here.
The first sentence in the preface of On the Pleasures of Owning Persons states the book's subject, quote, "This book is a study of the pleasures that slavery gives to owners," unquote. How did you come to write a book about this subject at this particular time?
I wrote it because I realized late in my life, I knew nothing about American slavery except through TV and movies. And I'm a professor, and I thought I was relatively well educated. But when I moved to the South in 1979, I learned I knew nothing about the Southern experience of the Civil War. And I knew nothing about slavery per se, except through Gone with the Wind. Or later in the 80s, I think it was, the Civil War series by Ken Burns. So as I became Southernized and lived with Southerners and taught them and was influenced by them, I realized I incorporated in my unsaid mind great prejudice against the South, that they were wrong, they, and the North, I, was right. I had to realize eventually that couldn't make sense to me because the Civil War was an American war. It had origins in American history, not in evil persons in the South, but in us, in me. So I asked myself, why did the war occur? What was it about? And how did we get there? Now, these are naive questions for professional historians. But I'm not a professional historian. I'm a citizen who, with some shame, realized I didn't know what happened in 1861 and 1865. And so I started reading, and reading, and reading, and reading, and reading. And I had to come across Lincoln before I got my point, my insight, which was, Lincoln says in the second inaugural about the war, this is early 1865, he's been reelected. He's looking forward to the end of the war and to what we call Reconstruction. And he says about the South, if we were in their circumstances, we might have done as they did. Very simple sentence. That struck me as profoundly empathic by Lincoln about the South. So if he couldn't hate the South, if he was able to understand something about our common human tragedy, I thought I should too.
So, what were, and maybe are, since owning persons still goes on, what were and are some of the pleasures of owning persons that you discovered as you were writing this book?
And I'll name five or six.
Okay.
I asked myself a simple question. If the war was about slavery, which it was, not about some abstract states' rights, then the question would be, why did Southerners own slaves? And the answer is, because they wanted to. Now, one might say, oh, come on. But the majority of owners were educated, powerful white men in the U.S. South. They had options. They had choices. And for 200 plus years, they had chosen almost entirely to own slaves. No one forced them to own slaves. So why? Well, here's two important answers. First, slaves represented tremendous wealth and potential wealth producing, not just by labor, but by procreation. A simple fact, stunning fact, is about 1820 or so in Virginia and other old Confederate states, more money was made by selling slaves westward than by produce in the fields. That means if you are a wealthy Virginia planter, or the sheriff who's under the control of the planter, or the state congressman, or the senator, or the governor, or the editor of the newspaper, you want a market for surplus slaves. Where will you sell them? The West. So if there's a question about Western states being slave or with slaves or without slavery, there's one answer. They shall be slaveholding states. So 1830 and 1840 and 1850, all the compromises about the expansion of slavery were absolutely determined by the value of slaves as produce and property that made people rich. Now that is a tragic sin, which is not rare. Slavery is a universal feature of most histories and most nations. It still occurs, as you know. There are about 35 to 40 million people who are literally enslaved in the world. In 1860, there were many, many millions who were enslaved. 1860 census, there were about 4 million Americans enslaved, mainly in the U.S. South. So, you own a slave because it has the chance to make you rich. The slaves became dowry, they became property that could be barred against, given in trust, and so forth. Many, many colleges inherited slaves. U.S. Grant inherited slaves through a bequest from family members. It wasn't rare at all. So on the one hand, slavery meant you had very cheap labor to exploit the southern lands, and you had reproductive access to human bodies, which under our innovation, chattel slavery, meant you own the children and grandchildren. Now that is not a universal feature of slavery. Some argue that we invented it. And there are some laws in North Carolina and in Boston where this was put on the books. Now, the other answer as to why you own slaves is because it gives one immediate pleasures. What are they? You own a wonderful part of nature, a human being. Human beings are marvelous creatures. In that sense, owning a marvelous horse is pleasurable. Owning human beings is owning creatures. There is no evidence that southern slave owners saw their slaves as animals. They knew that wasn't true. They didn't treat them like brutes. They treated them like human beings whom they had to terrorize sometimes to control. But they valued them intrinsically as human beings, as great objects of value. Second, when you own persons, you own their talents and their minds and their psyches. And one part of that is owning bodies. Now, I don't talk much about sexuality in my book, but there are important books that do, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners do. I don't for two reasons. First, there are beautiful studies that I can't replicate as a scholar on sexuality in the South. And second, novelists and poets and filmmakers need to articulate that, and they have articulated that really since 1900, in ways that are to be followed, not replicated by me. And finally, if we only focus on sexuality as a pleasure, we exclude many men and most women who did not take sexual pleasure in slave bodies. What did they take pleasure in? In ownership, first, of a human being, and second, in control, in hierarchy, in domination, and the luxury of being served and petted and seen as the object of devotion. If you read the histories of slave owners, including Andrew Jackson, for example, President Jackson, but also Stonewall Jackson, in their sort of self-obituaries and in their dialogues about themselves, they would often talk about their black families. I think General Jackson talked about, he hoped, that in heaven, where he knew he was going, his black families and white families would join him. Now, that's a fascinating idea. It's no doubt true that human beings who live around one another, who took care of his children, nursed them, had feelings of great affection just by perforce of being near them. But they didn't see him as a loving father. They saw him as an owner. I think Jackson took great pleasure in the fantasy that he was beloved by his slaves. Because after all, they were always very sweet and kind to him. And this is true if you ever go to a really fancy hotel or get bumped up to first class service. Suddenly, the server smiles at you and knows your name, and they serve you almonds and champagne. And think, I'm a likable person. Look at the beaming smiles around me. And then finally, or among other things, is attachment. To be in deep contact with house slaves and cooks and cleaners and boots and body servants who dressed you and undressed you is a form of intimacy, which is gratifying. Now, the English would call it the servants, the butler and the head housemaid. And as we know from Downton Abbey and Upstairs Downstairs, there are simulations of intimacy which are very gratifying to the owners. So, in all those ways, I'm asking us to empathize with the owners of slaves against our self-understanding that we would have been different. I don't think so. Could go back to Lincoln. Lincoln says, we might well have been as they. And I think that's true for most of us. When I hired one of my graduate students to help proofread part of the book, and he said later, well, Dr. Gay, I know that neither you nor I would ever have been a slave owner. I thought, Mike, you didn't understand the book. Because I'm saying exactly the opposite. Most of us are not heroic. Most of us would bend to the official ideology. The professors and theologians and ministers and rabbis who supported slavery, which were the majority, weren't moral monsters. Those who resisted were unusually brave people. And I talk about the Grimke sisters in one of the later chapters.
I think I'm going to actually go sort of out of order of the way that I was going to ask the questions, because what you were just talking about, I think, segues nicely into what I guess could be considered a sort of meta question about the book, which is the use of the plural pronoun we in the book. Sometimes we is used by an author or a speaker to claim everyone for a particular position, even when it's clear that not everyone supports that position. And sometimes we is used to distinguish a writer or speaker and their right-minded allies from the benighted folks off on a wrong path for one reason or another. But you seem to use we differently in a particular way, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your choice and the reasons behind it.
I think that's a subtle question. Good question. You make me confess something, which is I'm a closet theologian. A closeted theologian. Because we there means we as sinners. We as human beings. We as what Lincoln talked about, as creatures who are more alike than different, and who are shaped by circumstances, contrary to our grandiose sense of self. So that we, I'm trying to say, in the year 2016, can start to empathize with bad people, people who did bad things, who were on the wrong side of history. But we also have the chance to understand them in more subtlety, more context than usually is the case.
Just to follow up, the reason I asked that is I almost felt as if we was somewhat narrower and referring to either whites in America or possibly even more narrow than that, white Southerners in America. But it sounds like you had a sort of a broader...
The second doesn't hit me, as I mentioned in the book, and I said here too, I had to acknowledge my own arrogance as a Northerner, as if I were superior, or really as if the North were superior.
Right.
But it's not superior. Lincoln was, but that's an unusual genius. So it isn't so much we as even white. Now, being white is a crucial factor in American history, and I try to talk about that in the preface.
Right.
And throughout the book as well. And one of the obvious facts about slavery is it segued and fits so perfectly into European racism. Because if you bring traumatized human beings from Africa to South Carolina, and they are all black, and you are all white, or light-skinned, you have an automatic way to distinguish slave, not slave, 100 feet away, or 200 feet away. And with that, you have this interlocking device of profound racial categories that are entrenched into law, so-called positive law, up until our time, not 1865, but really our time, certainly my history from the 1960s and 70s, and even now, we don't doubt that being a young black man in America makes you a visible target in the way I, as a white man, have never been visible. And am not visible. So I take that quite seriously. No, I think the we is both sides' political spectrum that look at the Civil War as a cause that ought to be talked about in terms of noble sacrifices. And even Ken Burns, as I said, I think gets into this mindset of great music and battles and sacrifice and nobility, all of it true. The Battle of Chattanooga, the Battle in the Clouds, Battle of Franklin, Battle of Nashville, Gettysburg, these monumental events with great music behind it. That all puts aside the chronic sin of slavery, which is a chronic human sin of simply what I call the pleasures of domination. And in some sense, Southerners had a point when they said, well, the Europeans who criticize us, owners, treat their working people like hell. And they're right. They did and sometimes do. So, in that sense, they were justified in saying to the English lords who were anti-slavery, look at your own houses. And the Irish, for example, for a long time, could say, look at the English. They have treated Irish, and then later all the other races, with tremendous disdain. Not exactly slavery, but domination and control. Mm-hmm. So that goes back to we as well. Mm-hmm. I also think I'm trying to say the pleasures of ownership won't disappear because we talk about it. I think this is what I mean by inherent to human narcissism and sin. And we understand ourselves, we can look inside and say, I can grasp that. My student, I think, was wrong. He's a fine person. Mm-hmm. He can't own people now. So it's not, he won't be challenged. Mm-hmm. But to go to the other extreme, mm-hmm. you look at contemporary wars and around the world, or look at World War II, South France, I talk about, where the Christian French were completely aware of what the Nazis were doing, the Germans were doing. Most did not protect Jews. Some did. And their heroism fascinates me because, as I cite in the book, as one woman put it, we only saw persons, not Jews. Mm. But that beautiful simplicity, I think, is out of the gospel or out of the Hebrew Bible. It is contrary to hierarchy. In the South, those who freed their slaves were few and far between. Now, some did it out of moral or religious teaching. Some did it out of disgust in the early 1800s. Most didn't. Those who fought against slavery, like Sarah and Angelina Grimke, were vilified in the extreme and targeted. And they paid very high prices.
So, as you've already indicated this, that your book isn't really a history in the historian's sense of the term, even though you do some work, historical work, in the Shaker Archives at Pleasant Hill, Kentucky, and that's incorporated into your book. But what you do call your book is an essay in applied empathy, right. And you've already used the term empathy in referring to Lincoln. So what does that mean? What is an essay in applied empathy? What is applied empathy? And who do you, where do you get this notion? Is this just something that you kind of developed on your own, or?
Well, it comes from my work as a psychoanalyst, mm-hmm. a psychotherapist. But applied empathy would simply be self-consciously imagining myself in your shoes, mm-hmm. in your skin, mm-hmm. for a long period of time, A. And B, recognizing when I can my ignorance of your world. And this means being wrong a lot. When I work with, for example, women patients, I've learned an immense amount about being male by realizing, you know, what they know I don't know. Mm. So patients teach me like the way students teach us, naturally. We co-evolve. Mm. So part of my maturation as a therapist is having my ignorance at least challenged by people who can say to me, that's not it at all. And I couldn't have written this book at age 35. I wrote it when I was 60-something, I think, for those reasons. So applied empathy means I try and fail, but try to get to a point where I can grasp your feelings and your world as you live it. Lincoln, I mentioned in the mm-hmm. book, I think had this as a great gift. He talked about slavery quite beautifully as a boy. I think he was middle teens on a flatboat, maybe going down perhaps the Ohio, and he saw slaves chained, manacled. And he says he could imagine the bite in the flesh. That's empathy. Mm-hmm. Quite beautiful. And part of that, I think, was his engine that drove his anti-slavery sentiment. Mm-hmm. Because, again, notice numerous Christians, North and South, were not anti-slavery. And the majority of Southern slave owners, vast majority, were devout churchmen and churchwomen and Americans. They saw no problem with that at all.
So, though owning persons may have provided various pleasures, as you've outlined, you argue that owning persons also led the owners to be caught up in what you call the original contradiction.
Right.
And a good bit of the book is discussing the original contradiction and some of the ways that people dealt with it, at least among them the Christian people that you were just mentioning. So what's the basic nature of this contradiction, and what are some of the ways that folks dealt with it?
The original contradiction is simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's Jefferson's agony. The author of the Declaration of Independence, this transcendental document about human freedom, also owned human beings.
Hmm.
And that contradiction that we fought for human liberty turned into the Constitution of 1787, our founding document, our positive law, which has stitched into its fabric the protection of chattel slavery. That doesn't use the words,
mm-hmm.
because they were fought about in the convention. But everybody knew what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery would be, until exorcised from the Constitution, perpetual. So, everyone realized this. Karl Marx realized it when he wrote to Lincoln in 1850s, or 1860, and said to Abraham Lincoln, "You have, in some crucial way, tried to right the ship of the United States and get it back on its course of human liberty, because it's clear, was clear to everybody, that you fight for independence and liberty for all through a transcendental document called the Declaration, and then you weld into your law slavery."
Hmm.
And the only grounds for that were pragmatic, which is the argument you find again and again in the 1780s and after, is they couldn't found the damn thing without the South. And the South, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, etc., demanded the protection of slavery. It's not clear you could have beat England without Virginia and the other southern colonies, and Massachusetts, of course. So the compromises that went into the rebellion against England found their way right into the letter and the heart of the Constitution. And that was not changed until 1865, 13th Amendment, the beginning of the Great Amendments. So I try to say Southerners had to live this existentially. They were Christians. They were devout Americans. They believed in all those highfalutin values, but they didn't live them. And I suggest that is a struggle that is why the Civil War had to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't going to give it up. And Lincoln says it again and again. He says, I am in favor of the Union. And if it required all slave or not slave, so be it. But the goal of the Union was the expansion of human freedoms, as in the Declaration. So, as you know, for Lincoln, the Declaration was the sacred document. As an attorney and as a government official and as the president, he swore to uphold the Constitution. But the argument would be, to resolve the contradiction, you had to resolve slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So first you can constrain it from expansion, which is the platform of 1860. And then clearly you work to undo it in slaveholding states, which is why they left. They understood that.
So let's say you're a slave-owning Christian.
Mm-hmm.
How do you resolve this contradiction in your own
life? With great difficulty. I give three or four models of how one does this.
Mm-hmm.
The most obvious, I think, would simply be you split, to use that word. Monday through Saturday, you uphold every single tenet of power, control, intimidation, terror, browbeating, misuse of human beings, unimaginable cruelty. And you do it with the aplomb of someone who is superior and who tells himself, I am called to rule these lesser persons. Look at their dark skin. We know what that means. And look, they're not educated. Because, of course, we have denied them education. And they seem erratic. They run away a lot. They're unreliable.
Hmm.
You define them as a lesser form of human being, which needs protection and care, much better than what they got in Africa.
Hmm.
And all they need is discipline once in a while. Now, that requires cruelty. You know, so do stockades in the army. Then on Sunday, as it were, you affirm your Christian devotion to Jesus, who was a carpenter, not a king, not an owner, and whose person clearly is not one of hierarchy and control, who in the sacrifice is undeniably making himself the least among all creatures. He's the sacrificial sheep. Right? He's the lamb who is giving himself bodily, spiritually, for other people's benefit. That model of human being is not compatible with lordship over others. And so you just split.
Mm.
Monday through Saturday, one, Sunday, another. Mm. Another mode is very popular with the learned Southerners was you concoct pseudo-scientific treatises on why blacks are inferior. And then there's hundreds of those. There were farming journals. One is called DeBow's Review, which have in the journal mass something about raising corn or best kind of chicken for Carolina. And then there'll be managing slave plantations of fewer than 20. And then there'll be something on irrigation. They're all of the same logic.
Mm.
That these are all management issues which we simply rationalize as protectors of persons and whose role is guaranteed. They'll be safe as long as they obey. And they are producing great wealth for the South. And as I cite in the book, a subset of that is because slavery afforded Greek and Roman thinkers the luxury of time to reflect and create high culture in the classical period.
Mm.
So too, slavery will afford leisure and time and resources for people from Columbia, Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
or South Carolina, to create a new hierarchy, a new civilization. There'll be elites whose qualities and genius will guide us.
Mm.
The top of the pyramid.
One chapter in discussing the response to the original contradiction focuses on narrative fiction. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, because you do use fictional works of varying kinds. And as you said, I mean,
part of the inspiration, so to speak, in writing this book comes out of your realization that your knowledge of slavery, much of your knowledge of slavery, came out of fictional recountings. How does narrative fiction fit into your argument? What does narrative fiction afford, and what difficulties do you run into when you start thinking about narrative fiction's usefulness in defending slavery and arguing against slavery?
Well, those are great questions. One of them, for example, is the most obvious example is Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
Harriet Beecher Stowe's great work. It sold, I think, 300,000 copies in England within a year. It was, next to the Bible, maybe the bestseller for many years. Well, if you read that book, which I recommend, I hadn't read it until I wrote this book. It's online, it's free. It's a thoughtful, intelligent, and almost empathic reading of the Southern mind, pro-slavery mind, and the consequences. Remember, Simon Legree is not so much the owner as, well, he's an overseer, and his job is to instill discipline. But that novel became powerful because it evoked in ordinary readers empathy for the slaves. By humanizing them, by personalizing Uncle Tom and Eliza and so forth, and the baby. It also evoked archetypes of the endangered child, which is Hebrew Bible and New Testament. And it gave middle-brow readers immediate access to the moral universe of, is it right? Putting aside philosophy and politics and chatter. It was like a great film. So in some sense, it is like propaganda. That may be pejorative. It is a provocative telling of an important part of the truth. It is the opposite of Gone with the Wind, which is the early 20th century, but which tells a story about the elite whites and their nobility and their charm. And it's a brilliant book. I also recommend it. And it's a brilliant film. But the book and the film are narrative fiction that have convinced many, many whites, North and South, that in a way it wasn't so bad, or something like that. And you know the history of the film, which was that black audiences were aghast, and white audiences thought it was fantastic. And they have paid, and we have paid the penalty for that film. Right after Uncle Tom's Cabin was published and became an international bestseller, many, I think a dozen, white Southern women wrote counter novels about life, how good life was in the South. Those aren't as famous, but you can see the intuition was right. We have to counter this narrative. It's analogous to politics now. Most of us vote for a story. And there can be a turn in national elections based on a storyline. A brutal man misuses women or some such thing. Mm-hmm. That's all that matters. So, and narrative fiction provokes all of us most of the time. Religion per se mostly is narrative. Certainly, Gospels, by definition, are narrative. Most of the letters from Paul are stories about what he did and what's happening. Mm. Some of the Apocrypha, same thing, long stories that are telling. Preaching and other versions of instruction in religion, almost always narrative.
And you raise the problem, and this kind of segues into the last question I wanted to ask you. You raise the problem that of choosing between the narratives. How do we choose between the narratives? There's Uncle Tom's Cabin, and then there are all of these sort of Uncle Tom's Cabin. And I think that, I mean, my reading of your book is that leads you to discuss, quote, grounds for a universal ethic that transcends opinions, cultures, and traditions that are inconsistent with one another, unquote. And where I think you come out, and this involves a variety of different folks that you bring to bear, is an ethic that involves, quote, imagining a world of as if, think and act as if we were others, perhaps of different color or sex or intellectual endowment, unquote. And I think that,
right,
that has a lot of connection with what you were talking about earlier about empathy. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the sources that brought you to this ethic. And also, and this is a little bit playful perhaps with the term that you use, what pleasures might compel people to adopt this ethic?
Wow, that's a very clever question. on the first part,
yeah,
the as if comes from two sources. One is Christian ethic,
mm-hmm.
Jewish Christian ethic, I should say, where used by most of the abolitionists was the question, am I not a brother, asked by a black man, or am I not a sister, asked by a black woman. So the feeling, sentiment in the abolitionist movement was, these are brothers and sisters in Christ, i.e. creatures of God, and therefore made in God's image, and therefore of equal dignity. Different endowment, perhaps, but equal dignity. In some sense, that was Lincoln's take, though he didn't use theological language in the same way. But that's his take, that creatures, one and all, human beings, have an intrinsic identicalness about them, which we ought to respect. To me, that is a beginning answer, but it's not sufficient because it doesn't have an intellectual edge to it. You can imagine someone saying, well, that's true, but if someone has an IQ of 75 or 65 or 55, he or she will need more guidance and care. So this gives the racist ideology of the 19th century a foothold. The more radical answer really comes from Immanuel Kant, the great German ethicist, who simply said, what kind of world should we live in? On what grounds do you assess ethical claims? And he says you assess it by asking a simple question. Can I imagine my claim being generalized into a rule that governs me and my children? So, for example, if there's a rule that sometimes people can be enslaved or can sell themselves as slaves, and we think that's hunky-dory, then I have to imagine my children being enslaved at some point, or my grandchildren. Is that tolerable? No. Well, if it's not tolerable for me, then on the grounds of generalizing as a reasoning human being, it can't be tolerable for anybody. So that's the as if. Kant says, act as if the rules you use to live were universalized and brought back to bear on you and people you love. And notice that also requires empathy, because empathy is in itself as if. If I were you, what would it be?
So are there... How do you convince people? I mean, you have the intellectual armature, you have the religious traditions. How slavery, owning persons, had certain pleasures associated with it. What pleasures are associated with what you're talking about, with developing empathy, with acting as if?
That's a great question.
And it's a little bit beyond, I have to say,
beyond two.
What you say in your...
What's the final... the analogy I have to revert back to is my clinical work.
Uh-huh.
That when I learn something about myself through another human being, I feel better. I feel freer. Hmm. Something that was automatic and reactive in me is no longer that. I'm not controlled by it in the same way. Growing up in a racist America, I feel every day some racial tremors in myself. I see race. Most of us do. Certainly white men do.
Hmm.
And certainly white cops do. And black cops do too. So I find that true of myself. Maybe less true of the next generation. But the pleasures of insight, to go to your question,
mm-hmm.
are that we gain a little more freedom from being driven by unconscious forces. Among them, the love of hierarchy. And notice that is very close to the preference for the poor or the dispossessed. It says human beings as such cannot be constrained by their circumstances or by the accidents of their birth or their creaturehood. How do we have Syria falling apart, hundreds of thousands of families devastated by our actions and not help them?
Mm.
For example,
mm-hmm.
why don't we have more refugees in our country? And the answer has to be because we're unconscious. So far.
So far. Volney, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Again, I've been talking with Volney Gay, professor of psychiatry, director of psychotherapy training, professor of religious studies, professor of anthropology, and training and supervising analyst, the St. Louis Psychoanalytic Institute, about his recent book, On the Pleasures of Owning Persons, The Hidden Face of American Slavery, published by International Psychoanalytic Books. If you have any questions about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.